Welcome to the first in a brand new series called Rock Tales. We gathered a motley crew of music and entertainment industry veterans upstairs at the Coach and Horses pub in the heart of Soho to recount tales of their various experiences. We switched on the microphones and let it roll from there. So this podcast, or pubcast, contains some very strong language, the sound of food being prepared in the pub kitchen, and ambulance sirens from the street outside. But without further ado, let me hand you over to our host, Steve Blacknell.
Hello, my name's Steve Blacknell, and welcome to Rock Tales. I am a failed broadcaster, semi-failed actor, and a C-list presenter back in the 80s.
Hello, I'm Harold Marks. I was a record plugger, well-known. I was a music publisher, and a DJ, and a film extra. Appeared in several films.
Hello, my name's Patrick Humphreys. I began life as a hip young gun singer on New Musical Express in 1976 and have gone on to written books about Nick Drake, Lonnie Donegan and the Rolling Stones.
Hi, I'm Nick Carpenter, a radio producer, TV producer, live events, floor manager, stage manager. Been on numerous award shows behind the scenes and various shows and rock and roll things all around the world.
Hi, I'm John Maines. I worked in the music business for about 20 years in publishing and for the record labels. And after that, went off and compiled charts like the network chart for the Independent Radio Network. And now I'm a podcaster.
Oh, hi, I'm David Beeching. Originally a plugger back in the day. Ended up in artist relations at Sony, as it was then, and graduated into live events for the last 20 years or so.
Hi, I'm Nigel Hutchings. I was general manager at the Marquee during the 70s and 80s and is one claim to fame and put on a myriad of bands. I also have a tenuous claim to fame as having the first punk record recorded. I'm a mess with my band Stormtrooper.
Wow, what a mix. Okay, well, I'll roll one off then, as they say. So anyway, there,
chop one out.
Well, off you go. Okay. As an aside, yeah, well, before we started recording, we were talking about favourite moments and muck-ups, I suppose. I was the Herbert chosen for Live Aid. I did that trip with Phil Collins, etc., which was nice to be chosen. It was very nice, and everything was great until we got there. he went off to do his bit. Annie Nightingale wasn't around. All the links we planned were nothing. And so I then sat on the side of the stage with my MTV chums in Philly and I thought, watch Bruce Springsteen. Now, I obviously thought I did. Now, Patrick Humphreys, two chairs to my right here, I've been telling him, who's a Bruce Springsteen fan, what a chump Bruce Springsteen is, a bad pub singer and a very lucky man at least.
I agree.
And I've been saying that for years, one of the worst live acts I've ever seen. Patrick told me at a lunch, I think it was last year, that he in fact wasn't at Live Aid, which were sort of destroyed everything, and that's the amount of stuff I was on the day.
What were you smoking?
I don't know.
Well, Bruce, of course, that's Bruce Springsteen. I met him at the Albert Hall. He was doing the Ghost of Tom Joad tour, which was solo, and his manager and PR came and said, would you like to come and meet Bruce backstage? So you're going, well, yeah, I'll go on then. So you go backstage, there's Bruce, the manager, the assistant manager backstage at the Albert Hall. And I mean, what do you say to Bruce Springsteen? You know, I love all your records. I love your Born in the USA record. You know? Mm-hmm. So you just try and find something. And I said, well, you and your guitar out there, you're making more of a racket than Bob Dylan was with the band in 1966. And they booed him off. And Bruce says, oh, was that here? Was that that venue? I said, yeah, that was here. He said, all right. He said, would you like a beer? So you look at your watch again. Oh, go on, Bruce. Then you know if you're buying. So he tried. He got this bottle of beer, and he tried to do that opening the bottle of beer on his belt, and he just could not. He tried banging the table with the beer. And I said, oh, for fuck's sake, Bruce. I mean, John Wayne wouldn't have this problem. He said, no, you're right. So then we got chatting about favourite John Wayne movies. Surprisingly, Bruce's is The Searchers, one of the greatest films ever made. My favourite John Wayne film is The Alamo. Where he plays Davy Crockett. He's about to die. There's 6,000 Mexicans outside, and he's looking into the fire with the Davy Crockett hat, and one of his mates says, What are you thinking about, Davey? And John Wayne goes, not thinking, remembering. And I said to Bruce, if that line appears on one of your albums, I'll sue you.
So who did you see in Philly then? Who did you think?
Oh, well, in Philly, I really can't remember much about it now I think about it.
Did you fly over on Concorde with Mr. Collins?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Very good.
I just want to know who you thought was Bruce Springsteen.
I don't know. It was the most peculiar thing. Now I think about it, I think I saw.
I remember Hall and Oates and Madonna.
Hall and Oates, well, yeah, that's, I think so. And at the time, I was bulimic of the time of Live Aid, and I had been clear of bulimia for quite some years, but once I got on Concorde, I saw all these masses of food, all the journos reading and stuff. And considering that the task ahead was about famine relief, I felt very confused. And as we flew over Wales, I threw up into the Concorde toilet as Queen took to the stage. Weirdly. So that was my last time I was throwing up.
There's not many people who can say they've thrown up into the toilet in Concorde.
Yeah.
Whilst
yeah.
Freddie Mercury went on stage.
Exactly. I knew that because one of the hostesses told me that as they went across, Queen were on stage. Favourite moments? What about you? I mean, favourite moments like that?
Well, I've been extremely fortunate over the years to have met most of my idols, or however you want to say it, you know, people you admire. And it's always nice when you're working to actually be working with people rather than sort of meeting them as a fan, and to actually have a reason and a context for interacting with them. I think I've always probably been a David Bowie fan more than any other artist. I think I've admired him more than anyone. Very fortunate to have worked with him on the Brit Awards when he did that in 1996. And I don't know if people remember. He came out of the dressing room and he had the black tuxedo on and black very high stilettos with a sort of skull earring. Looked incredible. And Iman was with him, and immaculate as always, she was in this amazing sort of orange suit. And it was time to take them to the stage and cue them. And bizarrely, he got the Lifetime Achievement Award that year, and Tony Blair gave him the award. I think it was before Blair was Prime Minister. So there was this bizarre situation of sort of putting Bowie on stage, standing there with Tony Blair, cueing Tony Blair on. Blair gives him the award. Blair comes off, you know, or Bowie comes off rather. I hold the award while he goes back on to sing. And we sort of cue him on. But when we were taking him to the stage, you know what it's like backstage with cables and everything everywhere. Iman, who looked incredible in these orange heels, tripped on a wire and was a bit unstable, and he had to kind of steady her. But he had heels that were higher than hers. And I sort of cheekily said to him, I saw you can walk in heels better than she can. And he looked at me and sort of winked and said, I've had more practice, love. Which was a nice moment.
Yeah. Nigel, listen, so Marquee, did you meet any of your heroes at the Marquee?
Oh, many, lots. Well, you're fortunate at the Marquee to see bands start right from the beginning. AC/DC, Eddie and the Hot Rods back in 76 started with just a few people in the audience, and by the end of that summer it was 1,400 odd in there. And then I did put Genesis on many years later as a secret show, because we did host quite a number of secret shows at the Marquee because a lot of bands had started there. If they were playing Wembley or something the next day, then they would quite often like to come down there, bring their fans down. The Police did exactly the same. And we got all their fans in fact, the Police, through the back door. There were about 150 of them, I think. And Miles Copeland said, when the band kicked off, he said, oh, shit, there's not enough people in here. There's no atmosphere. So I went down to the front door and told the guys on the front door to get out there on the street and get some people in. So they're out there on the street saying, the Police are playing right now, you can come in for 50p, and nobody believed it. Nobody believed it. But yeah, many, many stories like that. But there was a funny story talking about faux pas and what have you. There was a band called Twisted Sister, who you probably remember from back in the day, again, started at the Marquee from pretty much scratch, did a series of shows, went around the country, went around Europe, ended up in Madison Square Gardens a couple of years later, and then came back and were doing Hammersmith or whatever it was they were doing, and wanted to do a couple of shows at the Marquee. Of course, booked them in. But they were very nervous because they hadn't been in a small club for such a long time. Anyway, trying to get them on stage on time, which was always the trick with all these bands, in that pokey little backstage dressing room, which some of you may have been in. They were late going on stage, and I went backstage, and I'm sort of shouting at them, come on, everybody, get on the bloody stage. We're late, you know, there's a curfew. One of the members, I won't mention his name because it might be embarrassing for him, certainly dodgy for me. He said something to me, and I said, fucking hell, keep your hair on, mate. And the whole dressing room went silent. Ooh. And it's like, oh dear. And it turns out he wore a wig. I never knew.
Oh, shit.
And anyway, there was a very pregnant pause there for a few seconds, and then they decided they'd get on stage, and off it went.
Yeah. Got away with that one.
Got away with that one.
What about Boy George, Harold?
What about Boy George?
Easy to work with?
Yes. Well, let me tell you this. I started in the record business as Plugger in 1969. My first hit record was Desmond Dekker and the Aces, Israelites. In 1974, I set my own record promotion company up, and I had lots of hits. Some years later, I heard that Boy George had formed a band called Culture Club, and I went to Tesser at Virgin Records, I used to do a lot of work for. I said, do you know this Culture Club record? I'd like to plug them. She said, no, you can't. I said, well, why? She said, Neil Ferris, who's a plugger, has got Spandau Ballet, Madness, and You'll Be 40. He's doing it. I said, but I want to do it. She said, no, you can't. So they had their first record out, which was called White Boy. They had the second record called I'm Afraid of Me. Tessa phoned me one day. She said, oh, Neil's going on holiday. Would you like to do a couple of weeks work on Culture Club? So I said, yeah. So I went to George's flat, and I met him. And he said, oh, we've got our first LP coming out soon. Have a listen. Tell me what you think might be the next record. Because if we don't get a hit, we're going to be dropped by Virgin. I said, did that reggae track, what's he called, Hurt Me? He said, it's too personal. So we have a meeting at Virgin Records with Simon Draper, who's in charge of A&R. Simon says to me, do you think this is a hit record? I said, yes, it is. Okay, the record comes out, Radio 1 don't play it. So I'm thinking, no, fuck, what have I done? So Gary Crowley was a DJ at Capital Radio at the time, lovely guy, started playing at Capital. We were getting some nighttime plays in Radio 1, maybe David Jenstone, or no one else played it. Shaking Stevens had a record out, and he charted. And Tessa, the lady in charge of promotion, went to rate to Top of the Pops. And that day, Vince Connolly, who's a friend of ours, was Shaking's plugger. Shaking Stevens either couldn't go on, he was either on holiday or the video wasn't new, whatever. So the next record in the charts, it was 22, was a band called Culture Club. So Tessa goes, yeah, they're free. So Michael heard the producer said, who are they? Never heard of them. He said, well, put them on. So we do the show, and I've got to tell you, I've never had a reaction to a band in my life as much as them. Everyone's going, who the fuck is this? Who is this boy girl? I phoned up Newsbeat. Oh, sorry, we don't have queers on our show. I went to see a guy called Dave Tate at Radio 1, who's the Breakfast Show producer, who told me he liked the record. He comes out of his office and goes, Howard, can I have a word, please? I said, yeah. He said, what the fuck was that on TV last night? I said, it was Boy George. He said, I can't play that, I've got kids. I said, Dave, you told me you'd like the record. Oh, he said, okay, because it's you, I'll play the record. So they started to play it. I got a record of the week on Radio 2. David Hamilton was doing drive time on Radio 2. A guy called Jeff Mullen was producing the show. So I phoned George, I was in Camden Town on the way home on Friday. I phoned George, I said, George, I've got some great news for you. I've got a record of the week on Radio 2. You just fucked our career. I said, what do you mean? He said, what, you arsehole, Radio fucking 2? I said, George, listen to me. Think of all the 45-year-old peroxide blonde ladies are going to, oh, I love that boy, George. He went, oh, I suppose you're right, really. Every time George was in my car, he would sing to me. And after Do You Really Want To Hear Me, it was Time. And he just sang this song, Time. And I went, oh, George, that's a hit. He said, that's the next record.
Can I just say that, funny enough, yeah, George was a real doer. And when we had a show called Riverside back in 81 on the BBC, which was not as famous as The Tube, although we got about three times The Tube's rating, but we were quite BBC. I particularly was trying to get Frankie Goes to Hollywood on it. Throughout the first series, George would come down every episode and sit in the audience. They used to say Riverside was the only show on television where you had to audition the audience. Because we were so trendy, we were up ourselves, really. But George would come down every week. Would the producers put him on? No, they would not. Would they put Frankie on? No, they would not. Frankie went to the Tube and made it, and they just thought George was all too weird.
Yeah.
They just couldn't wrap their BBC heads around it.
Yeah.
Most peculiar.
Yeah, strange.
It's funny you're talking about the AD knocking on the door, because that's always been my job, you know, having to go and sort of get the artists. Yeah. And it reminded me of the number of times I've worked or encountered Grace Jones.
Oh, yes. Yeah, another one.
Who I love. Yeah. I mean, she's a nightmare and a complete diva, but that's why I love her, because she is exactly as you would expect her to be. I remember one occasion I went to sort of knock on the dressing room door, and the door flies open. And she's standing there completely naked with her boobs in my face. She goes, "Oh, darling, I'm just getting ready. I'll only be a few minutes. I suppose you're on in 5. Oh, don't worry. I'll be ready, darling. I'll be ready." Slams the door and I walk away. And it was one of those award shows where there's the sort of prefabricated dressing rooms, you know, with those sort of stage flats and those sort of weird plasterboard walls. And I'm walking down the corridor, you know, I thought I'll give her 5 and I'll go back and get her. And I hear this absolute almighty crash and all the walls wobble and the whole building shakes. I'm like, what's going on? And I run back and I knock on the door and there's Grace, you all right? I don't, there's silence. I knock on the door again. Are you okay? Oh, this is worrying. So I open the door. Grace is standing there with her boobs out, holding a bar stool above her head. And there is a massive hole which she's smashed in the plasterboard wall. I mean, you know, this gaping hole which she's smashed through to the room next door. And I go, what are you doing? What's going? She goes, "Oh, mosquitoes, darling. Don't worry, I got the fucker." Literally swatting insects with a bar stool.
But what about odd people? Yeah, people you work with. I'll kick this one off. I remember Paul Weller was particularly nasty in interviews, and he tried to wind us all up. And I was doing the live MTV thing or something. I'm having a pee with him, and I said to him, "What should we talk about? What's the first thing we should talk about?" He said, "Well, let's talk about the new album." And of course, that was fine. We go live, I think it was live. So I say, "Well, welcome, Paul, and let's talk about the new album." He said, "I don't want to talk about the new album." And of course, that is more or less.
That's about it.
That was it.
Yeah.
And later, I think I did it too. A bit of a name drop to Tina Turner, I think it was, for MTV. And I was told, "Don't mention the divorce or something. Don't mention Ike Turner." That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And don't mention Ike Turner. It was about a day later that we did. I heard that from the manager, Rod Thingleybob. Don't mention Ike Turner. I forgot all about it. There we are on a beautiful hotel in London. First question. So tell me about Ike.
No.
Can we enjoy cut? Ooh, so you know that's the end of it.
Yeah.
When you started rock and roll journalism school, the three people just told you never, ever, under any circumstances, want to interview a Van Morrison, a Roger Waters out of Pink Floyd, and Lou Reed. Not a problem. Lou Reed has reputation preceded him. And when you go and do these interviews, they give you a sheaf of press cuttings. Lou Reed was in the Velvet Underground. I must make a point not to mention that. And they said, "What is your definition of abject misery?" Done a questionnaire for Vanity Fair. "What is your definition of abject misery?" So being interviewed by an English journalist.
Ooh.
I thought, well, this should fly by. So he wore dark glasses. I put my hand out to shake his hand. He wouldn't shake hands. All he was interested in talking about was guitar tunings, guitar this, guitar... He was fascinated by the technical side of it, and the only after 20 minutes I thought, we're just getting nowhere. And he let slip, he said, "One of the few benefits of fame is that I can register in a hotel as Philip Marlowe, because I'm a huge Raymond Chandler fan, and walking across the lobby hearing, 'Paging Mr. Morrow, Paging Mr. Morrow,' that brings a smile to my lips." So I said, "Well, it's funny you should say that, Lou," I said. Because I went to the same school as Raymond Chandler. And he said, "No, you didn't." I said, "Well, yes, I did." He said, "Well, no, you didn't." At which point in the interview you think, well, where do we go? I said, "Well, frankly, Lou, if you claim to know so much about Raymond Chandler, surely you knew he went to Dulwich College, an English public school, the same school that P.G. Woodhouse attended." And Lou Reed said, "Who's P.G. Woodhouse?" Oh. I said, "Lou, have we got some ground to cover here?" And for the next hour, we got on really, really. He was talking about Warhol, he was talking about the factory, he was talking about the Velvets, and the Velvet Underground box set had just come out. And I said, what are your thoughts on that, Lou? And he pulled the dark glasses down and he looked at me and he said, there's a very good reason they're called outtakes.
I did an award show with Lou Reed once, and I was taking him back to the stage, and he didn't have his, as, you know, as artists never do, he didn't have his laminate around his neck. And the security guard at the door just sort of stopped him. I was trying to say, it's Lou Reed, you know, you've got to let him, it's Lou Reed. And he goes, no, sorry, mate. And then Lou Reed just sort of stared at him, and it was just the classic sort of Paddington hard stare. I mean, he had the dark glasses on, so you couldn't even see his eyes, but Lou just stood there in the black leather jacket and rather menacingly stared at this very big security guy. And in the end, he just went, okay, you're all right.
Yeah. What about fleeting glimpses of heroes? I did a show back in the 80s called Knock Your Block Off.
And
it was a children's show, ostensibly for kids. We had poles and bodging poles, and it was a knockabout thing on a Saturday morning. And weirdly, a lot of the old rockers, because their kids were watching them, they used to, like Gilmore, for instance, would call me Mr. Knock Your Block Off when I worked with him. It wasn't Steve Blatton. Oh, he's not going to knock your block off, bro. So it was very, very strange. Indeed, I was at a polo thing that Kenny Jones was doing. And Clapton was there, and I walked out of the tent just at the same moment as Eric Clapton. A bit like Ivanhoe, when they come together at the, you know, you're just kind of really odd. We've ended up walking along next to each other. And I looked at him and I said, Steve Blackmore, knock your block off. And he looked at me and said, Eric Clapton, Cream. And at that point, we divided and walked off in our separate way.
I have a little fleeting prior to my marquee days. When I left school in 1969, I trained as a chef on the Isle of Wight at a place called the Halland Hotel. And all the bands for the festivals used to stay there because it was a big hotel. It was in Seaview, sort of out of the way. And although Bob Dylan stayed at my mate's house, they had a big manor house in Bembridge, and he stayed there, and the Beatles all stayed at that manor house. In the hotel downstairs, so I was a trainee chef. I was downstairs, I think I'd been doing some ironing or something like that, mundane stuff, you know, and I got into the little lift to go up to the next floor. There's this big black guy standing next to me, and it was Jimi Hendrix. I was scared shitless. I've probably never seen a black guy before, but this was Jimi Hendrix. I was in the lift with him, and I didn't say a word. I was petrified. So that's a fleeting glimpse, and that was a week before he died.
I saw Jimi Hendrix Experience 10 times live. The last time I saw him was the Savile Theatre, the night that Brian Epstein died. I was scheduled to go to the second show, and Brian Epstein came on the news, so I said to my friends, let's go anyway. We were standing outside the stage door. The show was cancelled, pandemonium. Chas Chandler walks out with Jimmy. Some guy goes, Jimmy, great show, man. Chas Chandler goes, don't you talk to my fucking boy like that, and punches him against the wall. And years later, I got to know Chas very well. I said, Chas, remember the night that he said, I remember it. I said, you punch these guys like you said, I remember doing that. And then there was people climbing on the limo to take them away from there. Amazing.
Just Jimi Hendrix, I remember I was weirdly going back, I was an Amen Corner fan. Very much, I was in Dave Clark 5 fan club, Amen Corner, and the Tremolos. They were my name. And,
and Searchers.
And all those things, I was a pop guy. I was outside in Dartford, and I'm going goosebumpy thinking about it, in my dad's rental Dolphin. And Alan Freeman comes on and says, and up from number 23 last week to this week's number 2, it's a little bit of Jimi Hendrix and Hey Joe, whatever. It's a really bad person. But basically, my hair grew about a foot by the time and I've always thought, instant hippie, just Ed Hendrix. And that was the end. That was the end of it for me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, my father too liked Jimi Hendrix, which really pissed me off. And he liked The Who as well, which really, he stopped at Mothers of Invention, I think, but basically, and the only way I could piss him off was to turn it up. because he'd come and listen to our experience, which was not the thing to do. No. Then I'd turn it up to, turn that bloody noise down. Job done. Generation gap achieved.
Brilliant. It's interesting that I saw Hendrix when I was 16 at the Isle of Wight Festival.
And you were there.
And I'd got a job emptying the backstage dustbins for a tenner a day, which to me was a fortune, an absolute fortune. And the brothers, who were the promoters of that festival, they were staying in the house in Freshwater Bay, who put it on, and said, do you want a job? So I had no idea I was going to end up in the record business, but we saw, at the very front of the stage, we got literally to the front and saw everyone that was on, the Doors, Hendrix, wow. Richie Havens, wow. All of those amazing acts.
Were you holding a bin bag? Yeah, mate.
Yeah, I had no idea I was going to end up in the record business then. No idea at all.
Well, I was there. I remember Hendrix was it for me. And I think the stage caught fire, didn't it? Or did it?
I think Rocket. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to mention this, because I always had a memory failure on it. A rocket whipped up. And it landed in front of me in a straw bale and ignited just like that. And it was a big panic for about 10 seconds, and everybody just put it out with a blanket because straw bales go up pretty quickly. Yeah, but you know, that was it, and it was over. But nevertheless, it caused a bit of
I thought it after it set fire to his guitar.
What was his name?
Arthur Brown.
The
Crazy World.
Yeah, that's right.
I saw The Crazy World of Arthur Brown at the Savile Theatre supporting Jimmy, and I've never seen anything like it at all. Amazing show. Amazing.
Very, very, well, one of the greatest one-hit wonders. And talking of one-hit wonders, raising his hand over on the right is Patrick Humphreys.
Chris Welsh is, thank you for that kind
words. Kind words.
My co-author. Chris Welsh, the Melody Maker, during the 1960s, was the raver. And he used to go to all these classic gigs. And he said, it's great, you could drive, you could park anywhere. He said, I was probably earning more money on the Melody Maker than a lot of the acts I saw. I give Rod Stewart a lift, I give her a lift. Mm-hmm. I was earning more than them. He said, when Billy Walker, the boxer, opened a club in the East End.
I went there.
And Hendrix, no, the Who, I think, were the opening act. And somebody in the audience said, oh, God, it's a bit old hat. And Chris is going, wow, this is all so destructive. He said, no, some American bloke has just come in. He's found the guitar with his teeth. So Chris gets in the old Morris mine and goes over to whichever club it was. And they were sent. So in one night, he saw The Who and Jimi Hendrix. Probably came to about, 12 and 6 or something total admission fees. Mm.
So my tickets to the Sabbath year were 15 shillings.
My little Who, I've got a couple of Who stories, but the one... with Keith Moon was a fleeting glimpse story. So I'd never met him before. And he came up Wardour Street riding on the side of a Rolls Royce, I believe it was, maybe a little bit of artistic license here, but riding on the side of a Rolls Royce and jumped off, came to the front door of the Marquee, invited himself in, you know, there's no... obviously not on the guest list or anything. Anyway, so I let him in, and he was truly off his head on whatever.
Really? Surprise.
Surprise, surprise. He then, after a bit, left and went up to the ship, wreaked havoc up there as well, and then went off to wherever he went off to and died that night. So, and that was the same as Bon Scott, exactly the same, similar story. Bon Scott from AC/DC, who I knew quite well because we put him on right at the beginning, came to the Marquee two or three years later after they'd made it huge and wanted to come in with a bunch of mates. We were absolutely chock a block, and I believe we'd just been fined by the fire department for over attendance. The legal limit at the Marquee was 400. The record was probably 1,460 for Jimi Hendrix, supported by the Nice in 69. The next after that, which is a bone of contention with Eddie and the Hot Rods and AC/DC, but it was AC/DC, got about 1,400 in 76. I wouldn't let him in, or the guys on the door wouldn't let him in because it was like, no, you're not letting anybody else in. He came up to the bar, found me, had a real rant at me and Jack Barry about, you know, I made this club. This club wouldn't be anywhere like it is today if it wasn't for my band kind of thing. And it was like, look, mate, you know, you can't come in. It's as hard as that. So, again, I think they all went off up the ship, and that night he was found dead as well. So,
must be the God drink help you lot.
So don't drink in the ship.
Don't drink in the ship.
It's gone now,
isn't it? To be fair,
he's
though,
the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
Whose offices were next to the ship?
They were next to the ship.
It was always the ship or the Nelly Dean.
Yeah,
that's it.
Those are the two pubs that everybody used to go to.
Talking about the other car pub, I went there in about 66 to see Otis Redding. I went with my mates, and I had Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, Eddie Floyd, Arthur Connolly, Booker T and MGs in the bar case.
Not bad.
I was only about 16. And it was a great one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. And my dad, my dad was a great Otis Redding fan.
My dad, just quickly before I forget, was an Everly Brothers fan. And whether or not it's true, I remember him telling me that one smoked a lot and one drank a lot. It was, smoked heavily and drank heavily? That's it, before I forgot.
I interviewed Charlie Watts once, and he came in and he looked amazing as always. Yes. He was very dapper and beautifully dressed in this handmade suit and shirt and everything. And he'd just come from Bonhams or Sotheby's or somewhere. And he was just sitting there while we were setting the mic levels, thumbing through this catalogue from the auction he'd just been to. And he said, hey, look at this. John Lennon's address book. They're flogging John Lennon's fucking address book. $20,000 for John Lennon's address. Who'd pay that for John fucking Lennon? I hated him. He was a miserable bastard. I don't want to see who was in his fucking address book. Now, if it was Fred Astaire's address book, that would be a different thing. I'd pay you $20,000 for that, because that would be fascinating.
And then Mick Jagger walks past, and my mate Liam goes, Mick, and he's got the microphone for the BBC thing. He goes, Mick, a word for the BBC. And Mick just comes out and goes, all right. And then walks off again. That was his word for the BBC.
The great Rolling Stones quote is when they said to Charlie, for one of the many anniversaries, what's it like, you know, 25 years of Rolling Stones? And Charlie goes, wow, it's 20 years of hanging around and 5 years work, isn't it? And that's it.
When they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there was a big do at the hotel in High Street, Kensington, the one with the flamingos, the name escapes me. There was a big do there, and I was covering it for Music Box or MTV or something. We went over to try and find Jagger, but at about 6 o'clock, opposite the hotel, there was Keith Richards, who was beer, Guinness, everything, juggling drinks so he could drink. This was about 7 o'clock in the evening, and he was like, We went back at 12 o'clock to interview him again, and he was just the same. I said, have you any idea where Mick is? And I can't do the voice. I don't know where Mick is. I don't know where the fuck I am. And he was just this blurt, just the same at 7 o'clock as he was at
But midnight. He's still with us. David Sinclair's mate of mine is a Times music critic for many years, huge Stones fan. And the obituaries editor called him in many years ago. He said, I know you're a huge Stones fan. The word on the wire is that your mate Keith is not going to make it. You've got to update the obituary. So David Dewley, with the heavy heart, sat down to update Keith Richards' obituary. 5 weeks later, the obituary's editor died. Now, I don't know what moral we learned from this, but, you know, Keith endures.
Yeah.
The cover of Let It Bleed, which is the Rolling Stones' greatest ever album, 1969. The cake on the cover was created by a young catering student called Delia Smith. She was given the brief to come up with the cake. She did. It's a terrible cover. The Stones always had terrible LP covers. You think about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's iconic. That's by the Beatles. The Satanic Majesty's Request by the Rolling Stones is not iconic. So they had no luck at all. Let It Bleed is a terrible cover, but Delia Smith did it, and eventually, years later, Mick heard that Delia Smith had created it, and he sent her a nice little postcard saying it was a very nice cake. So the Rolling Stones and Delia Smith, not a connection you'd immediately make.
Brilliant.
John.
going back to your fleeting glimpses and the night I will regret for the rest of my life. It was the Prince's Trust concert, 1986, year after Live Aid at Wembley Arena, and afterwards, obviously, after show party. And for some reason, I'd been drinking all day with Stuart Horner. Some of you may know Stuart Horner from Rondall Music.
Yeah.
And we arrived late, and we had two seats in the Royal Box, the row behind Prince Charles and Princess Diana. When they showed it on TV, you could see these empty seats for the first half of the gig. Anyway, cut a long story short, get backstage for the party. And we'd been doing a lot of work with Tina Turner because Graham Lyle and Terry Britton wrote most of the Private Dancer album and so on and so forth. And I met her a couple of times, and we're in the party, and I mean, everybody who was anybody was in this party. And she comes over to me, she says, "This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, John. Who would you like me to introduce you to?" And across the other side of the room, Jagger, Bowie and McCartney were standing in a group having a chat. I was completely off my trolley. "I'm not going any further."
I think we understand, yeah.
I said, "Well, yeah." Because it's weird. We've all worked in the music business. But when you meet an artist, it's very hard, even if you're working with them and you've got every excuse to talk to them, you get inhibitions from nowhere. And you think, what the hell am I going to say to them that no one else has said? We got halfway across the room and she's got her arm in mine. And it's Tina Turner. She would introduce me to these people and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, what the hell am I going to say? But the fact that she was taking me over, even that, the fact that a superstar was introducing me to three other superstars, I bottled it.
What did you say?
Halfway across the room, I said, "Tina, I can't do this." I bitterly regret that till the day I die.
No bloody surprise. I've admitted it in public.
Ridiculous, I know. Absolutely ridiculous.
Steve was talking about pop stars before, and we were talking about launches and boozy events and the like. To me, one of the weirdest things, I mean, as a plugger back in the day, when ABBA first arrived, Jeff and Louis were working in where I was working, and I think they dressed up as a bride and the bride and the groom and did the whole ring thing at Radio 1. And anyway, we eventually got Radio 1 to play some ABBA. And they all said the same thing. You know, you've had your one-off hit for Eurovision, that's it. So we got some airplay and it started to go. And then it was decided by somebody, not me, that we would try and get a TV show. So we got Thames at 6. And the idea was to do this press launch. And Steve's laughing because I think he's probably there. But the idea was everybody, all the journalists would be invited and all the people of influence on this boat on the Thames. And it would have a big sign on it saying ABBA, welcome. And it would go down the Thames. ABBA, meantime, would arrive at Heathrow and be filmed at Heathrow, get on these helicopters and fly to Battersea, where they would land and wave and then get on the boat and join everyone. Fabulous plan. In those days, unfortunately, if it was foggy, the planes couldn't land like they can now. So we waited and we waited and we waited. And finally, after about 2-3 hours, the planes landed, because they were coming from two different places. So I got them to Cobham, I got them on the helicopter, and in Yetta, what's her name, the blonde lady?
Yeah.
She was terrified of flying. And every single time we flew anywhere, she'd always insist on holding my hand, which, to be honest, I live with. And so finally, off we go in the helicopters, and as we're coming on the approach to London, a wall of fog in front of us. So there's three helicopters, all in all, because there's six of us. And the pilots, the helicopter guys basically the captain said, "Look, I'm going to have to turn round. If this doesn't break in the next 30 seconds, we won't be out of sea and we'll have to take these back." So luckily, just at literally about 28 seconds or whatever, there was a break in the thing and down the helicopters came. Helicopters land, we go to Battersea, they walk to the front and there's the boat. Wave to everybody, it's absolutely fabulous. Take the limousines, bring them right round over the bridge, down to the thing, where they join everyone on the boat. The only problem is, we were 5 hours late and there was a free bar. So by the time the band arrived, nobody could string a sentence together and no interviews were done.
Oh, well, those days.
Talking of the Prince's Trust, you mentioned the Prince's Trust gig at Wembley. There were a few of those subsequently, and I worked on one once. It was at the Tower of London, bizarrely. And I was employed, it's one of my favourite claims to fame, I was employed to keep the Bee Gees apart. Specifically because they were arguing at the time, and they said I think Morris had just died, so it was the first performance that they'd done as the Bee Gees with just Barry and Robin. And apparently they weren't talking and there was some issue going on. And they said if the two of them meet or talk or get any opportunity to kind of get into an argument prior to the show, they will walk. So they were given dressing rooms at the opposite end of the corridor. And they said to me, do not, at any circumstance, let them meet other than when they are walking to the stage to do their set. And so we were just sort of trying to coordinate this on the radio, you know, oh, Barry's coming out of the room, quick, divert, Robin, you know, go to the other side. Absolutely crazy. But that was a Prince's Trust thing. That was actually my job. Keep the Bee Gees from talking to one another.
End of part one.